Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome. I'm Dr. Deborah.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly. How are you over there across the world?
Gosh. Well, I'm literally sitting in a parking lot 10 minutes away from the oncologist vet for Prowler, who has him there, and he had his ultrasound this morning, and I'm waiting with bated breath. We get to talk to her right at 2 p.m. Pacific time today, so about 5 minutes from there doing the show, because the show must go on, right? And I'm also trying to not ruminate, because I'm trying to apply all of my tools to stay calm and not react to any information we haven't yet received. So we're going to hear today whether he's made progress or whether we have to go a different direction. So I'm terrified, but I'm okay.
Yes.
How about you?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm saying prayers. And it's so hard, not like, especially, I always say, like, waiting in the hallway, that in between you don't know is the hardest part, because you can't go one way or another. You're just sort of like sitting in it. It's really uncomfortable.
I know. And you got news on your moose.
So Moose has Cushing's disease, which is it's like a pituitary gland issue. And so we still have been playing phone tag with the vet. So I was reading up on it, and there's a medication that can help with symptoms, not necessarily cure it, but I don't think it's fatal. It looks as if most dogs get it later in life anyway, so it's hard to say. But I'm not terribly worried. I mean, I'm more sad that he's just uncomfortable. He's just, you know, going to the bathroom at night, and just a lot of, old man type of behavior, poor guy. So,
Well, he is like 91 in human years,
yes,
isn't he?
Yes, he really is. Ugh, my little baby.
He's up there. You've been so sweet to him. Birthday parties and all for the moose.
I love that guy. How was your weekend otherwise?
Well, I have to tell you a funny story. I swear I've been so sleep deprived, because Prowler does like to get up sometimes. We got to feed him on call. He's like an infant. He wakes up at 2 in the morning, he's got to eat. 4 in the morning, he's got to eat. So Chris and I have been sort of doing rotations, although he's been primarily getting up in the middle of the night. But you know what a light sleeper and a bad sleeper I am.
Yes.
So I wake up anyway. So I was so groggy the other night. I got up, and because of my back issues, sometimes I'm very cautious when I get out of bed. And I put my hand on the edge of the bed when I'm going to get up to go pee, right? So I put my hand down, and I think I've covered my whole palm on the mattress. Oh, no, only a quarter of an inch on the side of my hand. My hand flops down. I take a full spill tumble on the floor, and now I've bruised my kneecap like you cannot believe. It is so painful. Have you ever done that?
No, I've like knocked my foot into the, and that in itself is painful. So I can't even imagine. Oh.
So anyway, it's been a challenge. But other than that, I'm fine. But we did have the back in the emergency room, then the broken toe, and now the knee. I don't know. I'm just old. And I'm not that old. But sometimes, you know, when you got all this other stuff going on, it just feels like, life. But other than that, things are good. Tiffany is on a plane and about, she's probably boarded now. She's off to Bali for her tantric sex femininity sexual healing workshop, where she gets a teaching credential. Wow. So she'll be in Bali in luxury for the next 5 weeks.
Oh my God. That's amazing.
I know.
I'm jealous.
Isn't that exciting?
Oh, that's great. Wow. Oh my God.
And how about you, sweetie? What's up?
So, you know, we went to this place. It's called, knowing you, you probably heard of it. It's called the Hanson Dam. And it's like a little hidden treasure in LA. It's like this huge long pool with like two water slides. Up and I think it's like Sylmar. It's kind of like a random location. And so I took the boys on Sunday. They loved it, because it's like, you know, it's approaching end of summer. Like, this is it. So I was like, you know what? Last hurrah. And so we had a really nice time. It was great.
They are not back in school yet?
They are. But just like, it's you know,
a
the
weekend.
Weather.
Oh, okay.
The weather's, gotcha.
Yeah. I thought you said last time they're back in school. But you had this over the weekend.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you won't believe it, but I do not know of that place.
I'm shocked. Either it's not good, or, you know, it's popped up in the last 2 days, because you know everything about LA. So funny.
That's what happens when you live in LA your whole life. But anyway, enough about that. We should talk about our last week's guest, and you please say her name, because you're much better at it with your French accent.
So it's Ariel de Boison. Boison, something like that. But look, she was so relaxed. I think we could say it any which way, and she'd be fine with it.
Exactly. Giggles and Joy, Spiritual Life Lessons for Kids. The most adorable books with literally little things about how to handle different problems that kids come up with, you know, and teaching them about compassion and love and taking care of themselves and self-care. She was just a delight.
She was so sweet. There was something about her energy, and I love her books. And I was saying, and I'll say it again, it really calmed my kids. There was something about it. It was very meditative. So if you have children and you want to kind of get through some of those difficult topics like fear and anger and all of that kind of, or even just needing like faith and reassurance, I mean, her books are really quite lovely. So it was a pleasure to have her on. So today.
Okay. And today, do you want to go? Do you want me to go?
You go for it. I would have done it too.
Okay. Today we have Marilee McLean, or McLean. I'm sorry. Did I roll it? What is it?
McLean.
Thank you. Marilee McLean is a child advocate, domestic violence expert, national professional speaker, and author of Prosecuted But Not Silenced, Courtroom Reform for Sexually Abused Children. Marilee has written several articles for the ABA Child Law Journal, Women's E-New, and other publications on the problems of family courts not protecting abused children. Marilee is with Women's Media Center, The Source Expert, National Partnership to End Interpersonal Violence, and is the APB Speakers and RAIN Speaker Bureau. She speaks at conferences, law schools, and is a spokesperson for Protective Mothers. Her passion for advocacy developed through living a mother's worst nightmare, fighting the system with body and soul. She gained the insight that was not her nightmare alone. She organized a national rally of mothers at the Colorado State Capitol and has been involved in legislative work that spans over 2 decades. Welcome, Marilee. We're so happy to have you on the show, and what an important topic.
Well, thank you, and I'm very happy to be on your show. Thanks for having me.
We're super excited. So if you can tell us a little bit about, first and foremost, we know there's a huge story behind it. So why did you write your book, Prosecuted But Not Silenced?
I started writing that book when my daughter was two years old, when she was sexually abused, and I couldn't protect her in the court system. And I saw the system failing, and I couldn't believe what was happening. So I started writing it then. It was more, I was in a domestic violence relationship or marriage, and I wasn't sure I'd come out of it alive, nor was I sure that the emotional abuse, I'd get through what was going on throughout the family court system. So, and watching what my child was going through and not being able to protect her is like one of the worst things you can possibly go through. So I started writing it then, and it just kind of became a therapeutic tool, but I documented everything. And that's how the book, took me like 20 years, but all the documentation is there with the emotional story and then the research and the legal behind it. So if you're reading through that book and you go, oh, that can't happen, well, then it says go to Addendum A, and there's the police report or the doctor's report or the judge's order. So mm-hmm. I kind of backed up everything to show what's happening in the court, because this is happening nationally and internationally as well to thousands and thousands of women and their children.
Mm. Wow.
I just feel for you. My heart just breaks for you. I know I have a lot of clients who have been in these nightmare battles, and I know they tell their story and they look at me like, do you believe me? And of course I believe them, because they're so disbelieved. It's right. Just so tragic.
Yeah.
You're so courageous. Yeah. My goodness.
Well, that's the hardest part, because you think, you know, when you're first in this, and back in my time, obviously, this was in the 80s, and you just, I didn't know what I was up against. Then we didn't have the computers like people do today, or the internet, or books like mine that are out there to give, keep women from being blindsided by what's going to happen in the courts and not being able to protect their children. You would not even have a clue that could possibly happen.
Mm. So I guess if you can sort of like break it down for listeners who aren't familiar with this process, why is there such a, I don't know, I guess, why is our system so broken? If you can kind of break it down a little bit for us.
You know, what it is family court is not an evidentiary hearing. And so these cases are really criminal. If you or I were raped, or, you know, Deborah or yourself, when we were raped, that would go to criminal court. When a child's being raped and it's by the father, it goes to family court as a family court matter. Well, it's obviously not a family court matter. This is about child abuse. So once it gets into family court, a lot of the evidence is thrown out. The judges have their own discretionary ruling where they can bring in what they want and what they don't want to bring in. And so some of the evidence would not get in there. Lots of the evidence didn't in my case. And my case did go to the criminal court, and the criminal DA, the DA's office said, if that lower court takes that child away from me, we will step in to do something, because they knew my child was being abused. But there was never any prosecution of the abuse. Now, in my case, my daughter told policemen, doctors, social workers, psychologists, friends and family. Her daycare provider is the one that brought it to the attention. And then she came to me, and then I went to a pediatrician, and the pediatrician notified social services. Mm-hmm. And once social services got involved, the father had very limited visitation with her. So once they got involved to get supervised visits, a very, very short time. And these guys are charming, charismatic, you know, he was educated. And back then, people didn't want to think that a good, loving father would do this to his own child. And you can see it's not the strangers on the street, or it's not the boogeyman behind the bush. Most abuse, 90% of it, is by somebody the child knows. So anyway, I ended up in taking her to social services to visit with her father. And I met by a GAL, which is a guardian ad litem for the child, a lawyer for the child. And she gives me four things she wants to discuss with me. And I'm thinking, okay, I can handle this. I had just hired an attorney the day before. And you're going through the trauma. Imagine that your little baby's being abused. You're in shock over that. Mm-hmm. I had full custody of her. It wasn't a custody decision or anything to do with custody. It was about trying to protect her. And I'm thinking they'll do the right thing. I grew up in a family, really great family background, wonderful parents, wonderful family, thinking I just didn't know how the system could do what they were doing. So anyway, this is what's happening in courtrooms all across the country. I get calls every day from women all across the country with identical cases. I testified before Congress on this issue with 10 other mothers with identical cases to mine. I mean, it could have been me speaking. And they were doctors, lawyers from every walk of life. It didn't matter where you were coming from. Once there was sexual abuse allegations, it was as if you became the like the vindictive ex-wife making this stuff up. All those mother myths that they say women make up. I mean, they don't give them any credibility. And in that case, what happened with me, I got this GAL who latched on to a theory called parental alienation syndrome. Mm-hmm. And that's PAS. And she wanted to discuss four things with me when I was at social services with the father on a supervised visit. And I go into this little room thinking I can deal with this. And that was my first mistake, because they said to me, this is separation. I'm going to have you do separation counseling and him do it. Well, I've just spent 2 years trying to get away from this man, stalking me, emotionally abusing me. He had physically abused me. And I'm supposed to sit in the same room and discuss what's happening to my child. Mm. And I'm thinking, this is crazy. And then the next thing was, I said, well, have you read Dr. Baker's report? And Dr. Baker, the psychologist on the case, had just told me, yes, your child is being sexually abused and has been exposed to sexual stimuli. Mm. And handed me the report the day before this meeting. And she says, Dr. Baker does not state there's any abuse. I think, wow, am I going crazy? And then the next minute was, this is parental alienation syndrome. And I thought, parental alienation? I said, I've been over backwards for this man to be in her life. I had a great relationship with my own father. And I wanted her to have a chance to have the same. And at that moment, she said, this child's going into foster care. They took her out of my home. I'm the primary care parent. That's so damaging to children. It's such a huge, huge trauma. And put her in foster care and totally traumatized her. And even at that, I went into another room and I sat down and I cried as if I was going to die. I was trying to hold it together because I thought they'd say, oh, this mother's emotionally inept if I cried or want to scream. You know, that's how you would feel. And I let my head down on a desk and I was crying, sobbing, and the social worker coldly comes up and taps me on the shoulder and says, you can go say goodbye to your daughter now. Oh. And I couldn't even walk. I could hardly get up. My legs were shaking. It was a gray mist around me. And I start to walk down the hallway. I can hear the social workers and the GAO in the background. Look at her. Look at her. She can't handle it. She can't say goodbye to her daughter. I just kind of put my hand out to the side and said, oh, yes, I can. And I went in and said, honey, mommy has to go to work. She knew I wasn't going to work that day. And we were planning on going roller skating. And I lost her that day. They had the police escort me out, and I drove directly to Dr. Baker's office, and my makeup was all over my face. And she says, what happened to you? And I said, my God, they just took my baby from me. You know the truth. You fight for us. And at that point, she was in foster care, and more abuse came out in the daycare and the foster care. And they were bringing it to social services, and they were still not doing anything. And that was trauma. And then they ended up putting her back on my home. And once they did, I could not bring up the abuse again, although there was lots more evidence coming out on abuse. And so by the time she's 4 and a half, there's 3 police reports, 3 doctor's reports, and 3 hospital reports stating abuse, plus numerous, numerous witnesses. And still ignored all evidence. The more evidence came out on this case, the more time she got with her father, and the more I was silenced. Oh. And so I kept fighting. I never gave up. But I was lobbying in Washington, D.C., and I would lobby during the week. And I come back and I get on the phone with my attorneys, new attorneys, because I had lost custody after 4 and a half years. I lost custody due to the fact that the father was more able to nurture the relationship with the mother and child than the mother's able to nurture the relationship with the father and child. In the best interest of the child, statutes they use in the family courts, it's the parent that's more able to nurture the relationship with the other parent. Well, obviously, these mothers who are trying to protect their children don't want to nurture that relationship, and they don't want to be put together with that abuser, you know, to have to sit in the same room and discuss what's happening to the child. I mean, it was just all backwards. It's like re-victimization of the victim and the child over and over again. So anyway, I lost her at 4 and a half with an ex parte hearing, as emergency hearing by 2 therapists in the Colorado that sided with the PAS thing, parental alienation, which is not approved by the American Medical Association or the American Psychological Association. The guy that brought PAS forward was Dr. Richard Gardner. And he was, his books, he self-published, he sent them to every court in the nation. And they're not approved, and it's not scientific method, but there's still, that theory is still being used, whether it's PAS or parental alienation. So that's why I lost my daughter. And he stated in his own book, we need to have more pity for the pedophile than scorn. That it makes little girls and little boys better sexual partners. That this has been accepted in the Eastern culture. We need to accept this behavior, God's will. I mean, just sick stuff. And yet, none of us have been able to get the courts to listen, because it's really trauma, and the courts aren't up to what we need to be trained on in trauma. And the evaluators bringing in the information pretty much need more training on sexual abuse, and child trauma, to be able to be specific in those areas so they can handle these kind of cases and do what's right by the children. Oh, that's pretty much it. I went fast, I know.
Wow.
So much. Oh, my goodness. I have one question going back to the first part of your story. Did Dr. Baker, you said that in the court, it said that Dr. Baker did not concur that there was abuse, but that he actually did? I got a little confused on that part.
But yeah, no, I wasn't in court with, well, that did go to court, but no, Dr. Baker's report stated that my daughter had been exposed to sexual abuse and sexual stimuli. It wasn't the court saying that, she didn't state that. That was the GAL, the guardian ad litem, which is a lawyer for the child. Mm-hmm. She was put on the case for 3 months before I even knew she was on the case. And kind of behind the scenes, the father was working her, but that's not the only reason these cases go this way, with the manipulation and the control of that kind of a person, but more that did come out in court. A lot of this evidence came out in court, and they still handed my child over to the abuser. The police reports were enough to, I think, criminally prosecute, but it didn't matter. There was so much evidence there, and the more evidence came out, the more it got shoved under the carpet. And then the women end up being punished for bringing this forward. By the time I went, I wasn't in court for a day or 2 days or a week. I was in court for months at a time, weeks at a time. I had lots of news coverage on my case after I lost my daughter, because at that point, I did everything he told me to do. But once I lost her, it was like, I'm doing everything I can to get this out to the media and get people to know what's going on, because I was trying to get her back in any way I could get her back. And so they did an incredible job. 7 news covered it here, and they did an excellent job on it. And people were outraged. And then CNN, I went on CNN when I lost her. Excuse me, I'm going to go back. When I lost her at 4.5, I had supervised visits where I was treated as a hardened criminal for 8 years, where I got to see her 1 hour a week in a room 8 by 10 feet. Now, my daughter was the little girl that you guys all would love. And I know everybody thinks their own little two-year-old is the best, but she couldn't walk down the street without people stopping me to talk to her. Her eyes danced. She had personality plus and long dark hair. And as I would go into these supervised visits with her in time, her hair started to fall out, paper fine thin, and her eyes were in a trance-like state. And she would say things to me that were in that visit that absolutely, I mean, she would say things like she just wanted to die. Oh. And yet she was still forced to live in that situation. So to me, the abuse of her father was horrific and is horrific, but the abuse of the system is right up there.
So
for sure.
I want to just come to present day for a minute, because I'm just so curious. How is your daughter doing today? And kind of what's your relationship right now?
Well, you know, I got her back when she was 12 and a half. Okay. And at that point, I just told her, you see all those files under my desk? That's your case. And when you're ready to deal with it someday, it's there for you. And so in those next few years, all I did was try to get her back to normal as much as I could and healthy and have all her friends, the house, and just give her the life that she had lost a lot of. And she's dissociative. She had to block this in order to survive. And that's what these kids do, because it was so horrific, the pain she was going through. She used to tell me, Mommy, I fly to your house at night and I'm on the windowsill. I'm always with you. Mm-hmm. And so when she was, I know, it was a killer. And when she was 12 and a half, I can share this with you. I have it in my book, but mm-hmm. she wrote this poem that I think is incredible and actually explains her dissociation. She said, and I mean, this is pretty amazing that she wrote this. She says, I am a dreamer. I'm a dreamer lost in the world of logic and order, meaning the courts, you know. I wonder how big the universe really is. I hear the tinkling of fairies everywhere. I see an open ocean filled with mermaids diving in and out of the waves. I'm a dreamer lost in the world of logic and order. I pretend to glide in and out of the clouds with a flying unicorn. I feel that when I enter my world, everything is peaceful. I touch the barrier between the dream world and reality. I worry that someday my special world will collide with the real. I'm a dreamer lost in the world of logic and order. I understand that my dreams might never come true. This still makes me cry. I say that my world will last forever. I dream that I'm on a star looking down at the world. I try to keep my two worlds from becoming one. I hope my special world will never end, for it is my salvation from the troubles in life. I'm a dreamer lost in the world of logic and order. So she's pretty incredible.
Beautiful. Oh my gosh, that's incredible.
And she's pretty incredible. She's really suffered a lot, but she's really strong. She's very, very strong. And right now she's going through a lot because she's in that dissociation, coming out of the dissociation. Mm-hmm. So that's been a hard time.
And how old is she now?
She's 30.
She's 30. Oh my God.
Mm. And I don't know if you can even share this, but what kinds of therapies or modalities has she tried to help her with dissociation? And also, how about for yourself? Because clearly, post-traumatic stress up the kazoo, I would imagine.
Yeah. I've been in therapy with a really good therapist that I have had for years. And I just touched base with her on this stuff because, you going through this, it's so much trauma. And you kind of, you have to keep your head above water and you have to stay really strong. Like I tell all these mothers to get a black legal binder and put all your pertinent information and their emotions in there so that when you get ready, when you get ready to go talk to a congressman or a senator or a judge, I'm not a judge, but a lawyer, to get a lawyer to represent you or whatever, you need to have all your ducks in a row. So I did that. And and my therapy was, I had great family around me. I had lots of friends. I had a good job. So, I mean, a lot of these women don't have those things. They don't have parents to support them. They don't have anybody behind them the way they need. And then when they get supervised visits, like I did, a lot of them can't stay in there because the emotional, that part is worse than the family court system. I mean, they're absolutely grueling. Every time I would leave one of those visits, I cry all the way home and just come home and throw myself in her bed and cry for hours. So I don't think, and these women don't have the money to continue to do those supervised visits. So because they bankrupt you, mm-hmm. I went through hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees trying to fight to protect her. And then by the end, I was representing myself pro se. Wow. And I felt as though I had a voice. And having a voice, I think I did a really good job considering before I never had a voice in a courtroom. So I tell mothers, you know, it's not good to have to represent yourself, but some of them absolutely have to. And when you do, they know their cases better than anybody. Mm-hmm. So get out there and do it. Go represent yourself and get this information out there and get in front of those judges and let them know what's happening, what's really happening.
So I imagine,
right.
Has it been very healing? Has it been healing for you to hear from other moms? Do you feel like, oh my God, that's been kind of, this is my journey to kind of help other parents?
You know, honestly, I it's very hard for me. I get calls every single day, and every single day I have to hear these stories. I'm not a therapist, but they look to me for advice. They look to me to see that I made it. Like when I speak at the Battered Mothers Conference every year, it's either in Albany, New York, or it's in Washington, D.C. at George Washington Law School. And when I speak, those women just surround around me afterwards because to them, they see somebody strong up there that made it through this, and it gives them hope, and I got my child back. So I'm something giving them hope to get through this and giving them advice. Now, I don't give them legal advice, but I give them advice that will help their cases. Mm-hmm. And that's what the book is for. It's an educational tool for judges, lawyers, social workers, psychologists, anybody involved in the system, and for moms not to be blindsided by what's happening.
Right.
Wow. Your story is just, it's riveting. And earlier you talked about parent alienation syndrome and parent alienation.
Right.
And I know that that's not evidence-based and the courts don't recognize that, but it must be really a challenge listening to this, because I have also worked with so many people who have been on the side of a parent falsely accusing them, oftentimes a woman accusing the father of sexual abuse because she doesn't want to lose her children. She wants all of it. She's upset about the divorce. Maybe he had an affair or something like that. So how do you navigate in your own mind with some people who clearly do make false accusations versus those who are fighting for their life?
Really, really good question, because the studies will show that it's only 2% of false allegations that through the Kemp Center here in Colorado. But that's very rare that women come up with that. So I know that's kind of a myth out there that the woman's a vindictive ex-wife and goes in there to do that, because any woman that brings up these allegations, most of them are going to lose custody, because what happens is it becomes the alienation thing. Now, there are parents, absolutely, that alienate the other parent. That happens, absolutely does. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about abuse. And so in contested custody cases, most parents, they're good, loving parents, work it out. And they make sure, I don't care if it's a stay-at-home dad or if it's mom, whatever it is, they make sure that works. But in contested custody cases, most of those cases are abuse cases, like what I'm talking about. And those cases, the women are losing. They're losing in 70% of the time in contested custody cases where there's abuse going on, and 90% if there's sexual abuse. So those are actual statistics that are out there. There's a woman by the name of a professor, Dr. Joan Myers, that just did a study on parental alienation and parental alienation syndrome and how it's affecting the courts. An incredible study. And a lot of men will find a way to use that in order to get custody. If they use PAS, or the woman uses an alienator, bam, she's losing those children. So I believe everything I've seen, it's the opposite. It's not women going out there making false allegations. That's a myth.
Yeah, right. Wow.
Okay. Thank you for shedding light on that, because it is a very powerful mechanism that's being thrown out there in the psychology world, for
right.
sure.
And it's not scientific either way. You know, I mean, yes, I know. I mean, I've dealt with the people that have been alienated. I've got a father who's the mother took the kids to another country, and he's been fighting forever. And that is alienating. Absolutely. I don't care if it's the mother or the father. All I care about is the safety of the child. That is all they need to come up with in the court. The safety of that child, and a lot of this would stop. If they look for the safety and the health of that child, this would stop. We've got the ACE research study done by Adverse Childhood Experiences. It's done by Vincent Folletti. He was one of the main researchers on it. And that can help prevent a lot of this. Dr. Dan Saunders did a study, not Saunders, yes, Sanders, did a study with the Justice Office. It's a research on how much training these judges and lawyers and psychologists have, custody evaluators. And there is a lot more training to be done. They're going on old information, and we really need to bring that up to par because they need to be specified in child abuse, child sexual abuse, and domestic violence. And that's not happening. So I think that's part of it. And then just the PAS and PA, I'd like to see alienation just go out the window because what I've seen happen. But parental alienation syndrome is different than parental alienation. The syndrome was bought in by Richard Gardner, and that's to do with sexual abuse cases. Mm-hmm. And in his, I went on CNN International News, like I told you, and oh my gosh, they did an incredible job, an hour-long program, and they covered PAS. This was parental alienation syndrome. What is this doing to families, that kind of thing? Is this a way, and this is before it was debunked, and they no scientific proof to be using it. This is before that, and they had Dr. Richard Gardner on the program with me. And I'll never forget him saying, jail these moms, gag these moms. Well, guess what? Since the 80s, women have been being jailed and gagged. It's horrific. You should see how many. And these are good, loving mothers. These are not drug addicts, alcoholics, sick in any way. They're just trying to protect their children.
Oh, so we are talking with
absolutely
Marilee McLean, and she is the author of Prosecuted But Not Silenced, Courtroom Reform for Sexually Abused Children. So I imagine that there's a lot of people listening who are currently going through this. And if there's kind of maybe a few bullet points or advice that you can give to those out there who aren't familiar with your book or the system or anything like that, what do you recommend?
Well, I recommend that if your child, you suspect there's sexual abuse going on like that, you make sure you don't just jump at the first whim of it. Like, I really didn't want to believe this. I was in denial. I even asked my therapist, do you believe this going on? He goes, oh, my God, Marilee, of course this is going on. Because you just can't imagine, at least I couldn't, that a child's father and even her father would ever do anything like this. So I say get your ducks in a row as far as, you know, make sure you have documentation and proof of it. Don't just go out on a whim and think you're going to protect your child because you're not. You better have a lot of proof. Mm. And secondly, a good attorney that understands domestic violence and child abuse and child sexual abuse. Somebody that understands parental alienation. And you need to educate your attorney or you need to question your attorney. Don't just assume that. And that first attorney you hire, don't give them all your money. Because it can be $40,000 with that first attorney. You hold on to your money until you get an attorney that's going to do right by you and your child. And I would try to keep the GALs out. I would try to, that's the guardian ad litem for the child. I would try to, social services tends to unsubstantiate all these cases, and that's why they end up in family court. But I would warn them that if you go to family court, you may not be protecting your child. So I'd say take the blinders off, read, study this stuff. There's lots of good books out there, and my book is one of those books that can help you and guide mm-hmm. you. I've got lots of to-do things, like, I don't know, maybe 30 different things to do and maybe not to do, so that will help women get through this, navigate a little better. And once they see a case study of how this comes down, it'll prepare them better for what they're going to be hit with. Is there anything else I can tell you?
These are excellent. I just want to take us a little bit off of that topic and more toward just being in abusive relationships in general. I've been in several abusive relationships in my life. One happened to be a terrible 7-year run with a sociopath. There was no, thankfully, child abuse issues. But I think it's really important. I mean, I certainly learned some things in hindsight, signs and symptoms and things that I didn't pay attention to, red flags. Maybe if you can go in that direction a little bit. How long did you date this person before you ended up getting married? Were there any signs?
Yes, absolutely. But you know what? I was married in the 80s, and domestic violence to me was where a woman was beaten black and blue or eyes black or whatever. I was emotionally abused, and he was definitely a sociopath. I say when I speak, it's he was a cross between a sociopath, psychopath, and a narcissist. Mm. But what I'm saying is he was a definite sociopath, and he mimicked everything that he knew I wanted to hear or that I wanted to believe, or that he is this really good guy. And so I tell women out there, especially young girls when they go to colleges and stuff, my gosh, beware. You guys have all the red flags out there. You can pick up any book. You can pick up any internet and read about domestic violence. And you have the red flags. Where I didn't know what I was up against. You have that. And when you see those red flags, my gosh, you better run. Because you have a child with that person, you are in this for life. You do not get out. And there are lots of red flags. The coercive control, the stalking, the emotional abuse, the financial abuse, sexual abuse. There's a million different things that you can look at. And I just remember, you know, seeing signs. I read an article, and I don't know what magazine it was in, but I was probably 25 years old. And I read an article that said about a psychopath, and it went through all these emotions that they put you through and all this stuff. And I, you know what? I cut that article out of that magazine and I put it in my drawer next to my bed for all those years. And I was living with exactly that. And you know, I had to have known it somewhere that I put that in my drawer and kept it close to me. Mm. So, you know, I mean, he would write in journals for many years. And when I divorced him, I went to a therapist because he was doing so many scary things to me. And I told the truth about my marriage. And she said, what are you doing to protect yourself? And does he have a gun? And I thought, oh, she's overreacting. So I took, because he never would move his stuff out and he had these journals, I took them into her and I copied several of them. And there were scary things like how he had demons inside of him that are clawing and writing along, how they dwell agonizing pain through it and blows to his guts and howl as they write along. And just how he has met his greatest enemy, meaning me. She's mine to conquer and destroy. Example, Nietzsche, stuff. And so I gave that to her and she said he had incognitive behavior, paranoid ideation, and could be the writing of a very disturbed and conflicted individual. And she told me back then, if ever my child was left in his care, she would be unsafe. And I thought she overreacted.
Wow.
He's sick, but he's not that sick.
Right. You start to rationalize it. Yeah.
Add to what you were saying earlier about these signs stuff. I think one of the signs that women especially, and also men, need to pay attention to is what's going on within us that we attract someone like that. Because I've learned from myself is that victims re-victimize themselves. Mm-hmm. And my desperation for love and all the things I didn't get in childhood that I was searching for, I was a ripe and ready target for predators, because predators need to find the weak and vulnerable. And they do, and they have like almost like this insane radar. They can smell your vulnerability. So if you are in a bad relationship and you're ready to get back out there, it's so important to really heal from within, right?
And even at that, I mean, I did come from a great background and I didn't have those things, but I think they look for certain people that are really nice and they can manipulate and work. I don't think mm-hmm. it's so much as that person's damaged, as I've seen lots of women that are kind of just too nice, in all honesty, and feel sorry for them mm-hmm. and pick up on that side of it, and they know it, and they pick up on it, and they get you to fall in love with them because they're so charismatic and charming, and then they lash out at you, leaving you gasping, like, what the heck just happened? So you have to know that when that kind of behavior is happening, there's something wrong there. You just don't keep going in this emotional spurt up and down, up and down, up and down, you know, because the good is so good and then the bad is so bad. You know, mm-hmm. I don't know.
Right. And do you have any fear of doing all the speaking and all that stuff? Like, where is he now?
Oh, absolutely. I didn't publish my book all these years. I waited until my daughter was old enough and I just told her, I went through a lot of fear. I mean, I had a rally at the Capitol back in 1994, the year the VAWA Act passed, and women came in from all across the country. These are all mothers from every single state was there, because we had a mother get up and say, Iowa, are you here? Montana, are you here? And there was somebody from every state. And then there was a woman named Joan Pennington who was a domestic violence survivor, and she became an attorney because her husband used to beat her, and he beat her in one eye until that eye went black, and then she went blind in that eye, and he started her other eye. And she's been on the Capitol steps of New Jersey with her five children trying to get help. And then she ended up going to law school and she started a clinic. And so all these mothers were calling her, like myself, with this going on. And she talked to me about having a rally at the Capitol here. So we put that on. And I mean, it was an incredible rally. And we thought we were making a difference. 1994, the VAWA Act just passed. you know, I figured that, you know, with all the news coverage, we were going to get our children back. They were going to turn around. It was a great grassroots effort. There were, Gloria Steinem wrote a letter. They had congressmen there. I mean, it was, and great musicians, and it was a great rally. But yet, nothing changed. And yeah, at that rally, he showed up with two huge black men beside him, and had a fanny pack on the front of him. And I was up on the podium on the Capitol steps, and Julie Hayden was the news reporter. The Channel 7 News, they're all news stations were there, and I thought, well, he's here to kill me. And I went over to her and I said, he's here. And she says, where? And I pointed him out. But I was scared to death, of course. And then when my book came out, I mean, I realized he didn't kill me all those years because he was enjoying soul murdering me. They, you know, like he said, I've met my greatest enemy. She's mine to conquer and destroy. Really, that's what I was. He did not, he wanted to destroy me. And there's no better way to destroy a woman than to take her child and watch her child suffer, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, the soul murdered me. That was, he'd kill me, that'd be over with. But the soul murdered me for the rest of my life, that's the best way to go. But he didn't realize how strong I was. And so I never gave up. And yeah, I've lived in fear, but I'm not in fear anymore because what I did in my book is I backed everything up. There's no way, all the evidence is there. I have all the evidence. I have tons of evidence. So there's no way. And if he did anything to me, it would be somebody else. It wouldn't be him. I just don't worry about it anymore. You can't live life like that. I don't worry.
And so... kind of to present day, does he try to contact your daughter? Like, I mean, how is that?
Okay. This is the hard part for anybody to understand, and it's probably the hardest part for me. My daughter, picture her as a Stockholm syndrome.
Yes.
She had to live with her abuser.
Mm-hmm.
And I can say this. One of the reasons I married him is because I thought he'd be such a great father,
mm-hmm.
because he's a great dad. Mm-hmm. I mean, he comes across as that. I mean, he could take a child to La La Land in 2 seconds. So my daughter loves him still. There's a part of her that absolutely loves him still. And she's going through all this. I don't know where she'll end up once all of this comes out and what she's going through. But that's the hardest part for me, is to know that she still loves him and has him in her life. I mean, I don't say anything. I don't do anything about that. I've got to let her be where she is. But it's really painful to me to know what he's done, what he's caused her, the harm for her life, her health costs to her, all of it. Yeah, I know what happens to these children, and I know what happens to them as they grow into adults, and I know what happens for the future, what's lying ahead for her because of his damage. Mm. So, yeah, it's frustrating.
Oh, I can only imagine.
So she does have current contact with him?
Yes, she does.
Wow. So he's around.
I mean, they're not together or anything like that. But I mean, she does talk to
right.
Dr. Deborah,
be so hard for you.
Is that very common?
It is.
I imagine that. Yeah.
I don't know.
The Stockholm syndrome.
I don't know. That's the hard part for me. I mean, most of the cases that I know, the women that were in this, I mean, some committed suicide, some ran in the underground, some went to bed. I have one mother that was at that rally with me, was a very strong mother. And today she's bedridden and they never see their children again. So I don't know. I don't have the stats
right.
Like my case is where my daughter still loves her dad. Don't know. I guess if she goes through this and she deals with all of it, maybe she'll still even love him. I don't know how that works. I don't understand it.
But that's what we know, is love is not logical, right? You can take all this logical stuff and you develop an attachment. People will do so much to be loyal to their abusers, to protect them, and even to the point of not even seeing them as having been abusive. It's frightening. I mean, I see this in my practice all the time.
My daughter fought him, though, when she was little. She really did. I mean, she told me absolutely. I mean, she was so strong. I mean, I don't know. I never saw a child. I mean, I never talked to her about it. I just let her talk to me and then change the subject and go on to something else, because I didn't want them to say I was coaching her, because if I said anything, the mother said, so even if I took her to the hospital, the nurse would say, ask me a question. I said, don't ask me, ask my daughter, because mm-hmm. if I said, she says, then it would be the mother saying, so I let my daughter tell them everything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she was so articulate and she came across with everything. It was, you know, child could do. And yet how disappointing to her. She'd say to me, Mommy, who are the good people? Who are the bad people? Because she couldn't understand why nobody was protecting her.
Wow.
And she'd tell me, Daddy, my daddy says he'll stop, but he doesn't.
Oh.
And there's lots of things I won't. It's in my book. I don't go on to detail on any of that on the air, but you can read it in the book.
And so I imagine this must be traumatizing to continue to talk about it. Or do you feel like each time you talk about it, you're healing a little bit more?
No, I honestly, I'm really pushing this book right now because I'm trying to get this information out there, and I'm pushing this on it because we're working for the Child Safety Act and safety of the child to come first, and the health of the safety to come health and safety of the child to come first.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm doing this to make a difference. It's hard for me to do. I'll be honest with you. This is very hard for me to talk about.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would rather just tell you what's going on in the system, but people can't get it clear unless they hear a story. So I give them my story. And yes, it's very hard for me to talk about. And it's very hard to take all these mothers' cases every day. But you know what? Somebody's got to do it. And there are a lot of us working on it. There's Stop Abuse Now is out of New York. You've got California Protective Parents Association out of California. You've got Center for Judicial Justice. There's lots of organizations working. Fight Back Foundation that I work for. We're trying to make a difference here.
Yeah.
And that's what I do. This is what I don't think this is what I chose for my life. Maybe I did. I don't know. Mm-hmm. They say psychologically you choose these things. I don't think I did. But this is what I'm in, and this is my passion, and I have to make a difference. And it's not about my child and I anymore. It's about the thousands of other cases that have come after me.
God, wow.
Well, you are one remarkable woman. I will tell you that. Amazing for you to do this and have the stamina and the perseverance and the courage. Oh, we are so grateful
yes.
to have heard your story and for you to be able to share that with our audience. Just amazing. I'm kind of... at a loss for words, actually.
I
think, Kelly,
yes.
you want to fill in the words?
Yeah, I mean, you're just so brave to do this. And, you know, I love that you're kind of saying, you know what, this is a message that needs to be heard. And I'm willing to kind of sort of put away my hurt and my trauma because it's so important that nobody else go through this. And you are just such a pioneer in this, and we so appreciate, you know, you really sharing your personal detrimental story with us so that we can help others. And so again, we've been talking with Marilee McLean, and the book is Prosecuted But Not Silenced, Courtroom Reform for Sexually Abused Children. And if people, so you recommended a couple of those great organizations. I mean, is there like a forum or places if people have additional questions where you can advise people to go, or your own website or anything like that?
Yeah, I have my own website, which is MarileeMcLean.com. So it's MARALEE. McLean is MCLEAN.com. And you can get information there, and there's lots of more information there. And then also I'm on Facebook, so you can go there, and you can also go to my Facebook page that I have is my book Prosecuted But Not Silenced. So there's a lot of other mothers' stories on mm-hmm. on that page, the Prosecuted But Not Silenced page, and information that's going on.
Thank you so much.
Wow. I feel like I need to do a meditation.
I know.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so goodness. Much.
You're very
really
welcome.
Appreciate it.
It's for all the moms and children out there suffering. Okay.
Yes. All right.
Well, thank you guys for having me on. And let's pray that
thank
this
you.
Makes a difference.
Yes.
Okay.
For
have
sure. Absolutely.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Well,
so,
a whole different version next week of
yes.
parenting, right?
Yes, exactly.
Dr. G's Guide to Effective Parenting. Get the behavior you want without being the parent you hate. A good lesson for all of us.
You know what? I've listened to a ton of parenting advice. And I watched my mother-in-law sent me a video that she had, and I was super impressed with her methodology. So yeah, very excited to have her on.
Or her mythology. I'll take mythology too. Why not?
Good. We need
Instagram at Two Shrinks. And
yes.
Facebook, the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show.
All right.
We love you all.
Take good care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.